2014 to order, and the first order of business is the appropriate action related to the minutes of the May 7th, 2014 meeting. Anybody got any changes? If not, can I have a motion?
So motion.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carried. Next is appropriate action related to Timco Board Committee assignments. And Lee, welcome again. Are you still on there?
Yes, sir, right here.
All right, well, this is very important because we're gonna load you up. Be it resolved that Director Lee Hobson hereby designated as a member of the Audit and Ethics Committee of the Board, member of the Compensation and Risk Committee of the Board, and the Chair of the Compensation Committee. And let me explain to you that both Kyle and Arden will buy you dinner because you've taken that. All you need to do is just organize a dinner, and by the way, make it expensive.
Congratulations, Lee.
Can I have a motion?
Very much. Learned a lot from listening to you, Kyle.
Can I have a motion for that resolution?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor, aye.
Aye.
All right. Another important part of the business is Kathy. Kathy is moving on to another phase of her life. And Kathy, we want to recognize, you know, the substantial contribution that you've made to UTEMCO with a resolution from the board. I've only known you for a short time, but Arden, you may have the longest relationship with Kathy, but in a short time I've known her, I've come to really appreciate her advice and counsel and the contribution to this particular board and to UTEMCO. And what I'd like to do, this one's fairly long, but I think Kathy deserves to listen to the whole thing, Kathy. Here we go. Whereas due to her substantial background and expertise in business as a certified public accountant, certified financial planner, and 15 years as an accounting, tax, and investment professional, Kathy was hired by the University of Texas System Office of Asset Management in 1991 as a manager. Trust reporting, later advanced to director endowment administration to manage the corporate endowment fund operations for the Board of Regents of the Texas. Texas A&M, I just nearly slipped in there. The University of Texas System for the benefit of the citizens of the state of Texas. And whereas, when the University of Texas Investment Management Company was formed in 1995 as a Texas nonprofit corporation, engaged exclusively to provide investment management services to the Board of Regents of the University of Texas System, and began operations in March 1996. Ms. Eisberg was hired as Vice President, in which she served as the Corporate and Investment Fund's Chief Financial Officer and Compliance Officer, in addition to overseeing three investment support areas: security operations, accounting, and information technology services. And whereas from April 2001 to April 2002, Ms. Eisberg assumed the interim president and CEO duties in addition to her duties as managing director. Investment operations, and subsequent to the end of this term, advanced to the position of managing director. Whereas as managing director, marketable alternative investments, and deputy chief investment officer, Ms. Eisberg provided invaluable insight and direction in the investment of hedge funds. Because of her extensive experience in all areas of UTEMCO investment and operations matters, was again asked to and served as interim president, chief executive officer, and chief investment officer, in addition to her duties as managing director. Whereas September 21st, 2007, Ms. Eisberg was appointed to the position of president and deputy CIO, responsible for investment oversight of the endowment funds and management of the public markets, fixed income, and hedge fund investment groups, and will continue to serve in that capacity until her retirement from UTEMCO, August the 31st of this year. Whereas Ms. Eisberg's leadership, commitment, and service during her 5 years with the University of Texas System and 8 years with UTEMCO were exemplary, reflecting her dedication to the success of the University of Texas System, the benefit of an education and development of students at all levels, and further evidenced by the growth of the assets managed by UTEMCO from $9 billion in 1996 to more than $34 billion in 2014. Extremely impressive. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the directors of the University of Texas Investment Management Company do hereby express to Kathy their sincere appreciation for her leadership, commitment, and service to the University of Texas Investment Management Company and the University of Texas system. And be it further resolved that all persons who read this resolution should know that Ms. Iberg has made a lasting and fundamental contribution to the University of Texas Investment Management Company for the benefit of all the citizens of the state, particularly the students and the faculty of the University of Texas system and the Texas A&M University system. I'll assume we passed and adopted this. I don't really need a motion, Bill. Everybody's solidly behind it, the 29th day of July, 2014. And you can take this, you can frame it and put it on your wall.
I go, boy, that made me tired.
It won't be as good as the paycheck, but it'll be close.
Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Yeah. And I used Eisenberg rather than Iberg because I have a very good friend and it just popped up. So I apologize for that.
Thank you.
Okay, Bruce, let's see. Next order of business would be the endowment and operating funds report.
Yes. I'll again try to go quickly. I'm on page 14, diligent, page 2, behind tab 3. The numbers are as of May, the quarter, third quarter in, total of $33.9 billion of assets under management. As of the end of June, that number was $34.5 billion. On the next page, we show the returns. Again, we've got the June numbers in. So for the 10 months of the fiscal year to date, we were at 13.7% for the PUF and 13.3% for the JEF, 10.3% for the intermediate term fund. The only other number I'd mention is that for the 1 year ending June, the returns are 15.9%. I mention that number because most other endowments have a fiscal year end of June 30th, and so we'll begin to see, and public pension plans, et cetera, so we'll begin to see what other institutions' returns were for the year ending June 30th. And so our comparable number is 15.9% in the PUF. Let me jump to page 6 in the paper copy, page 18 on diligent. Our value add for the 9 months of the fiscal year is only 29 basis points in the JEF. Now, it's 65 basis points in the PUF. We have one mandate with a Chinese equity manager that we have in the we have a different allocation between this manager's general fund and a special account we have. That varies. That's the only difference between the PUF and the JEF. And the special account we have, the other way around. And so that accounts for the difference. Our active management value add, 127%. Below target, above target slightly, but below what we've historically done. And then again, this fiscal year, our gold position has hurt us. It's hurt us over the last 3 years. Since inception, we're actually 15 basis points ahead on the gold, but not a lot. So that's been the, as we parse returns, active management's working, not as well as it has in the past. Tactical management, primarily the gold, has continued to weigh us down this year, the last few years. Page 7 are various widely accepted measures of risk-adjusted returns. They look good. Page 9 in the paper copy, 21 in diligent, we do have the overweight gold position, and our long-only book is run up some. And then the source of funds have been in the broad for the gold is really lower bonds and lower broad commodities and a little lower natural resources related public equities.
Bruce, could you comment with regard to the gold now that the if the board adopts the policy change recommendation to bring gold into the benchmark, what
the target's 2.5%. We're at 3.1%. We're probably going to get close to that target in a not long period of time.
So the negative alpha from the tactical accordingly goes away.
Yes, sir.
Goes way down.
Yes, sir. As well as any prospect from positive alpha from that tactical allocation.
Sure, it'll turn around.
Yeah, that's a signal to buy gold, right, for us. It worked for a few years, and then it didn't. And overall, it's worked a little bit. The next page just shows our continuing hedge positions, and we have very little, 6.6 basis points of cost. Interestingly enough, the vast majority of that was the first one we ever put on about 5 years ago when we were somewhat worried about inflation. Obviously, we haven't experienced it, so that was some insurance we bought that we didn't use. And then let me just turn it over to Uzi to quickly go over some of the other risk metrics and optics and prisms that we use in the portfolio.
Okay, thanks, Bruce. So on page 11, 23 diligence, there are several measures. Unfortunately, can't capture risk in just one number, but I'll try to give just a few. I will not talk about downside risk and standard deviations. But on liquidity, we can see 42% in 3 months, so it's plenty liquid. This has not changed from last quarter. The number that is ticking up is unfunded commitments. We had 18.5, now 19.3. That's part of us building the book. Also on the manager concentration, on the risk side, no change from previous quarter, but on the assets, we are getting more concentrated, Jeff's point. On the next slide, geographic exposure. Overall, we have in North America 56%. There are two comparisons here, which you can see at the top, for example, GDP and global market cap. On GDP, developed markets are just two times relative to emerging markets. On market cap, about four times. As I said, we're 56% exposed to North America, and if you look at the bottom, it's driven being North America centric on the hedge fund, the SEC book on privates. These require more developed financial markets, capital markets, and it's also a tactical bet. The U.S. has been a good place to be, so to the extent that our manager did these bets, these were good bets. Next slide is excluding fixed income, because fixed income could skew as a different risk profile, but basically it looks very similar. We also have geographic exposure. Let me just a few words on the next slide, slide 14. This lists the countries one by one, the top 11 countries. You can see as you go down, the 11th Hong Kong is just 1.1%, and obviously goes down further down, it's even less than 1%. So it's not big bets on the esoteric countries. If you think about the BRIC countries, you see here China, Brazil, India, Russia is not in the top 11.
We had a good conversation in risk committee about our geographic exposures. We spent time talking about Russia, and so that was, I think, a good...
Share the number for everybody, what we got in Russia, 125 million?
Yeah, about 50 basis points. I think we've got 120-ish million in a public equity manager, 125 in a public equity manager, and we've got about 40 million of NAV and about 30 to 40 million of unfunded commitments, I'm looking for Lindell, in two Russian private equity managers. We have one Ukrainian private equity manager where we've got about 30 million invested, nothing unfunded.
On sector exposure, let me skip to slide 16, 28 on diligent, which is what's called beta adjusted, just a better way to total the numbers up. And okay, on the top left is the total endowment exposure. On the top right is an all country as a comparison. This is again a way to look at the bets or the exposures that we're making. A lot of the bigger
bets are driven by the composition of our private book. That's strategic. That's the way the portfolio, the policy portfolio is built with a specific allocation to energy, natural resources. So we have 15%, we have 18% in energy here. Real estate also is a strategic allocation with 15%. And we have a venture book, so that kicks up the information technology. Basically, it flows to the similar exposures or bits at the total endowment. Moving on to the next slide, concentration. And we have on the right side the biggest single name exposures we have. And the main point I want to make here is we're very diversified. The biggest name we have, which we have with a few managers, one of them is one of our largest managers that also is concentrated, and then a few of the hedge funds, it's still only 0.76%, 76 basis points of the total portfolio. So from exposure in terms of single names, we're very diversified and probably over-diversified.
Does that include private equity as well? Private equity, yes. Or public equity, or
yes,
both?
It's both.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and there are a few names on the bottom which are private name. We did not list the names, but
I think eight. So most of these are public equity, and most of these really are driven by one manager, ValueAct, that we have a lot of money with, 700 million more.
4%.
How much? 900 million with. And they run a very concentrated portfolio. 10 stocks make up a large percentage. So those are the names. And they've done very well for us.
Yeah.
This is a idiosyncratic concentrated bet that's working out so far. If you say that 75 basis points, 58 basis points of exposure is idiosyncratic and concentrated.
Was that a shot?
No, sir. Just trying to provide information. But I take shots, me.
On the next slide, slide 18, on the paper copy 30, on diligent scenarios. So we try to look at different scenarios, and again, a few numbers of what we think could happen to the portfolio. It's not necessarily the worst case, but as we were thinking about things that could happen, and we ordered them from the worst to the a bit better, kind of the worst scenarios we came up is we titled it U.S. liquidity squeeze, but basically mismanagement by the Fed, let's call it. And we see here expected policy returns of a loss of 25%. So this is something, not saying it's going to happen tomorrow, but there are scenarios that are at least we see possible that we can lose 25%. We also do things like a repeat of 08, and the number is larger. But if we try looking forward, we see a scenario of 25%, a scenario of 21%, which is based on EM. And as Bruce said, we do not have a lot of protection at this point. We do not have any hedges on, or hardly any hedges. It's important to note. In terms of tactical, we're not very defensive.
And I'm sorry, so by the way, on this U.S. liquidity squeeze, basically rates go up, we go into recession, equities, U.S. equities, we projected to go down by how much?
40%.
So again, because of this diversified portfolio, the overall portfolio is down only 25%, but this would be an equity market that's down 40%.
And to be clear, Uzi, when you're developing this forward-looking scenarios, is it you're going to each member of the staff that runs that particular portfolio and said, if this were to happen, what do you estimate would happen to your particular asset class?
Yes, we do that at the asset class level, and we want to refine it more to do it actually at the manager level.
And by the way, Kyle was gracious enough to host Uzi, Kyle and Kyle's risk manager, and I think Uzi conveyed to me how helpful he found that, how valuable it was, and So we're looking to put more tools in our toolbox. So thank you.
In scenarios that could happen, if we're looking at the downside, we're seeing returns of endowment returns -23% or -19%. It's can be hit by big numbers. Another way to look at it, sensitivity, we're most exposed to equities, a 0.55, let's call it beta. So if markets are down 30%, if just equity is down 30%, we would be down 0.55 of that, or 16.5%. And you can think whatever number, if markets are down 60%, we'll be down 33%, whatever the number comes up. So that's exposure in terms of equity exposure. This is by far our largest single factor risk. And I think that would summarize what I want to say about.
Uzi, it seems that this may be is more along the lines of what Arden might have been thinking of when he used the term downside risk. And so in some sense, I think you do answer the question. It's just maybe not where.
Yeah, I think the term might have been misleading, and I agree. One more scenario which we discussed at the risk committee, it's not here. Some of the scenarios are not as headline catching. They're just long, and whether it's the late 70s in the US, last decade in Japan, in fact, they can be even worse in terms of when you have market returns of 2-3% and inflation of 10%, which we had in the 70s. The endowment can be 7% behind just inflation, not to mention that it's not making 5% real, and in the 70s that lasted for 5 years. So it's not a 3-month kind of shock and awe like we had in 08, but for long-term investors, these are things that could be as bad, if not worse. So this is also a scenario where.
And Uzi's done a great job with the staff of, you know, they've always, in the past, what they've done is done analyses of prior events that have happened throughout history, and this is a page of potential future events that haven't happened before. So they're thinking both in the past and the future, which I think is a great step in the right direction.
I agree.
And what I think I can do a better job of is making sure we communicate not only to the risk committee and the UTEMCO board, but to our client, the Regents. And by the way, I'll be at the A&M Regents meeting in September. Kind of the full array of risks that are attendant in a portfolio like this. This is the next page, page 19 in your paper, 31 on Diligent. This is our kind of asset exposures. And you know, we've already talked about a fair amount of it. The long only investment grade fixed income, $1.5 billion, 6.1%. Total fixed income on the right, 17%. So six of that's long only bonds and of different durations, including cash. We still have about 8.7% in credit related fixed income. Particularly the private part of that's coming down, as is the hedge fund part. We're up to about 21.5% in real assets. A little under half of that, 9.6%, is in privates, almost 4 in the real estate book, 5.7 in broadly diversified natural resources book. We have 2.5% in REITs, of that 8.9% in more correlated and constrained natural resources, about 3% of that's gold. The rest is kind of roughly split between broad commodities and natural resources, public equities. We continue to have just under 26% of our book in public equities, 15% in developed country, 10.6% in emerging markets. Hedge funds are 28.8% of the total, and private investments 27.9% of the total. And then, you know, what I'd like is to have each of the investment team heads tell you a little bit more about their portfolio, starting with the bond book.
Morning, everyone. If you turn to page 20, you've got the MCC investment grade fixed income book. On the left-hand side, you see our performance for relevant periods that we've noted before. In the 1 year, you can see that we had the hiccup that was associated with the taper tantrum from last year. Fortunately, if you took a look at that through the end of last week and did a 1 year number, we'd be about 30 basis points from that. So we're pleased with that. As well, on the right-hand side, you can see the makeup of our book, four managers that we have currently.
And the change here was we redeemed from one manager.
Yes,
and we're about to invest with another.
We redeemed from Old Mutual Asset Management early in May, and in the next week, we should have another fixed income manager that's Global X US in place. So looking forward to having them.
And they are?
They are First International Advisors. They're a boutique that's owned by Wells Cap.
They've been, and they run about $6 billion, I think.
It's closer to 5.
5.8. And they've been around for 800. These guys are not right out of college.
Yeah, they're the core of their the staff has been around for 20-plus years. And they've been running Global X US money for the duration of that. So.
And their historic track record, at least historic, has been quite value add.
It's been very nice. We like their information ratio, and we think they'll be added to the book, both in reducing volatility and adding some returns. So.
The only change is our money with them, and we hope that won't change their track record.
Should.
All
right. Should. Moving on to page 21. On the upper left-hand side, you've got an overview. Our modified duration, which is a measure of interest rate risk, is about 0.5 less than the overall index that we use, while our yield to maturity is about 90 basis points higher. If you look over at the upper right-hand corner, you've got our geographic exposure. We continue to be underweight in Europe and Asia Pacific in particular. The Asia Pacific negative 3.5 underweight mass and a underweight to Japan of negative 10%. If you look at our overweights, we're overweight to the US and to emerging markets. In the emerging market, primary overweights are to Mexico and Poland. Lower left-hand corner, you have our currency exposures. We are underweight to the euro and the yen. Little bits of the sterling with major overweights in the dollar and to emerging markets. Those emerging market currency overweights include Mexico, South Korea, India, Malaysia, and Chile. And finally, in the lower right-hand corner, you see sector exposure. We are overweight to Treasury and Sovereign with an underweight, notably to securitized. And as I've mentioned before, I think that's driven largely by the Fed's distortion of the mortgage market with their purchases. It's really driven a lot of value out of that market. And you see that across our managers' books. They're simply not attractive right now. So are there any questions? One thing I'd like to say in conclusion is that Cassie's been a wonderful advocate, boss, mentor, and friend. Me and to Harlan, and I'd just like to say it. Thank you.
I'll echo those sentiments. The public REIT portfolio was $857 million at the end of the quarter, representing about 2.5% of the endowments and just under 3.4% of the ITF. For the first 9 months, fully returned 15.4%, which underperformed the benchmark by 50 bips. Sort of a repeat here that the underperformance is largely driven by our underweight to the U.S. and overweights we've had in Asia during the fiscal year. Just to put that into context, the U.S. has done return 19% in Asia. Real estate portfolio has returned 7%. For the 12 months, we did outperform by 100 basis points, but this was all really largely driven by the first 6 months in that year as sort of investors chased a lot of yield and drove up performance of as our managers were well positioned for the downturn that we incurred as everybody sort of reversed that yield trade that we were going down. The last meeting I mentioned that we've had the poor performance in the three and the five-year basis, which was largely driven by sort of dislocations in the market that were in the second half of 2011. And we have been working on doing some upgrade initiatives on the portfolio. And the snapshot that you see isn't fully reflected in what we've done here. So just to give you a sense of the turn in the portfolio that we're doing, you see the passive portfolio. U.S. REIT there is a kind of part capital as we've redeemed from one of our U.S. strategies. And then as of the end of the month, we're moving that over to Brookfield for a U.S. mandate that they have with us. In addition, we're terminating one of our global managers here, and we're going to see Brookfield's long-short strategy that we spend a lot of time with. And lastly, I'll say we're actually spending some time on another U.S. mandate and also have a view that we're looking at our next U.S. Transition that we're going to make on that measure as well. So all in, you're going to see a good 70% turnover in this portfolio here, probably by the end of the year.
So I think that last part was related to European investors, which is now public information.
Yeah, it's
is it?
Yeah, so we're evaluating there. They've had some transition, some change, and we're evaluating how much change to expect there, and to the extent that. We're
again, to be less oblique, because it's public, so we can share it with our board. It's not public.
Partially public.
The part that's public, why don't you go ahead and share with your board?
One of the heads of real estate has left, and he's joining Northwood Investors platform to start a securities platform.
And Northwood is has been up to now a private real estate investor that we're a significant partner with.
Yes. So we're in process of just evaluating the team he may build there.
On the commodities portfolio, this is kind of a snapshot in time that catches us transitioning the portfolio pretty significantly. We had at the beginning of the fiscal year three strategies with three managers. We've terminated one of the managers that ran about a third of the portfolio and that had underperformed by a couple hundred basis points. About a week after we terminated, the manager resigned. So there was clearly some internal turmoil in that shop, and I think I was pleased that we got out ahead of that. we added the Wellington Select strategy, which you see there in the upper left. It is a much more discretionary strategy. It's my view that in today's market, the sort of benchmark-oriented, low-tracking error strategies are not the best strategies. They don't address the opportunities in the market where we've seen more volatility come into the commodity space. The Wellington Select strategy is a customized strategy in a separate account that we added. We negotiated with Wellington where they've got much more latitude. They can go short. They can employ leverage up to 200% gross. And it's a very, very discretionary strategy that allows them to take advantage of opportunities in the market. We funded that initially with some of the proceeds of the redemption in May, where we just recently, over the last 2 weeks, redeemed fully from Gresham, which is the partner on the right of this pie chart. That is being allocated across the two Wellington strategies to the tune of 60% in the select, more discretionary strategy, 40% in the less discretionary core strategy. Fiscal year to date, the Wellington core strategies outperformed by about 250 basis points. The select strategy has outperformed about 100 basis points a month since we added them in March. So the combination of these two, I think, are much, much better, not just in terms of the portfolio manager talent, which I have high conviction on, but also the strategies themselves. You know, again, to be clear, they're both in separate accounts. They're both custom strategies that we negotiated with them to run for us. And I think we're really benefiting from Wellington's very, very deep fundamental bench of research analysts that supports the portfolio manager, to say nothing of their, what I think is probably pretty close to best in class institutional platform in terms of risk management, reporting, and everything. So we're in a much, much better place, in my view, going forward.
And with the target for the endowments being 2.5%, if this book was 2.5% and then whatever target for the ITF, I don't remember, how much would the 800 million still be 800 million?
So as we redeemed, we are currently capped, back to the discussion of delegated authority, Jeff, we're currently capped at a new commitment to anybody of $750 million. So because we were
if there's $750 million with a manager, we can't make a new commitment.
Right. The most we can give to a manager, $750 million.
But it's give plus investment returns. If we gave them $500 and they earned $250 and we now have $750 with them, we can't give them anymore.
Right. Okay. So we now had
coming back to the board.
Without we don't have the delegated authority.
So we had a little bit more than 800 million in the book when we began this final redemption. So we just essentially sent that 50 million back to the House. So we'll now have, on a pro forma basis, 750 million split between these two separate accounts, 60-40.
And if we're, but we're, the target used to be 3.75%, and we're bringing it down to 2.5%. So if we were at 2.5%,
it'd be about $850 million.
So it'd still be 850
yes.
million.
Yeah, okay. So we're underweight commodities,
underweight commodities
by policy.
Okay. And we could come and ask for,
we could,
an option to review, but we're just, we're not at this point.
So okay. we're going to be slightly overweight equity, slightly underweight commodities relative to our 50-50 benchmark is what it amounts to.
Mark, on the Wellington Select, the way you described it, it must have come pretty close to being more appropriate for the LCC portfolio than MCC.
Great observation. We're within the bounds of MCC.
Yeah.
So, but it's I would say butting up to that line, and I would have been okay if it would have been LCC. Obviously, there's some implications around that, but we negotiated as such that it was within the.
We anticipate their net long being.
Net long yeah. being close to 100%.
Right.
I mean, they're.
And
they
so their beta
is
still
yeah,
beta one.
Think of it as a 130-30 type thing.
Yes.
I mean, it's not. It's 200, but, it's not like they're going to be
right.
neutral or net short or, even 0.5. They're going
to
be.
They have to notify us if they go over 160 gross. So basically that 130.
Do you expect the volatility of the Wellington Select to be greater than your core?
Yes, potentially, because of the leverage. Yes. So it'll have, if you want to think of it in terms of tracking error, it'll have a higher, much higher tracking error. They are not benchmark constrained at all in that strategy. And then flipping over to slide 24 on the equities book, the only big change, well, there's really been two meaningful changes to this portfolio. We've added, the last passive exposure we had was the MLP holdings we have in the lower left there. We've hired an active management strategy within the last couple months there. That particular strategy, again, separate account, custom set of guidelines, that manager's outperformed that benchmark by about 500 basis points on an annual basis. So we're hoping we added some really good alpha there. That is a total off benchmark position. So there's no MLPs in our equity benchmark. It's been, as I'm sure Jeff knows and others, it's been a great add to the portfolio because MLPs have done so well on an absolute basis. It's added about 100 basis points of performance. BlackRock Metals, that beta in the mining public equity space has cost us about 50 basis points, just the beta. Metals equity, mining equities have been completely decimated, not the least of which were the gold equities. The portfolio manager there resigned in January. We had a conversation with the head of that equity complex before he left and supported having him leave. We've got two new co-portfolio managers there. Since they've taken over in January, they've outperformed by about 100 basis points their equity benchmark, so I think we're in a much better place with them there now. And I'm actually somewhat positive on that beta going forward. I think we've paid the price for having it, but I think going forward, it should be additive to the portfolio. We will rebalance this portfolio over time, both within these five now active mandates and also to bring it down a bit to be in line with fiscal 15 policy. But if you look across both the equity and commodity portfolios, on a long-term basis, they show about 200, 250 basis points of outperformance. That's sort of the minimum I expect going forward. I will say our portfolio is very oriented towards smaller cap growth stocks. So in a down market, we will suffer relative to our benchmark. And in a low-vol commodity market, I think we will suffer. So, you know, there are markets where I think our portfolio isn't optimum, but over the cycle, I think we will outperform to that extent.
Susan, before you start on the developed equity, I should mention that Russ, I think that was the first time any of us ever saw any emotion from Russ. One was he will miss Kathy. The other is he now reports directly to me. I'm not sure. And I mention that because if Susan starts crying also, you'll know the factors. So Susan's going to have to report directly to me. Is Amanda here? And I just want to mention, you know, Russ and Harlan have been here for 20 years, 16 years or something. Am I close?
26
years. Combined or just
Kathy walked in.
Before Kathy walked in. Susan and Amanda have each been here for about 6 years, and so please don't cry.
So slide 25, you'll see for the developed country book, fiscal year to date, we've lagged a benchmark slightly by 30 basis points. 12 months in May, we've lagged a benchmark by 20 basis points. It's not entirely surprising because we do expect our managers to lag in stronger markets, which is what we've had over the past year. Fiscal year to date, we've been hurt by an overweight to Japan, where the broad market has returned less than global developed markets, as well as poor relative performance from two of our global managers and one of our U.S. managers. In terms of our portfolio composition.
I'm sorry, Bruce, could you ask her to speak a little closer to the microphone?
Can you hear me? Okay, in terms of our portfolio composition, the pie chart on the right, we have one new manager since last quarter, Ashe Capital. They're a concentrated, value-oriented, U.S.-focused managers founded by two ex-ESL principals, and they'll focus on U.S. equities and may take a constructive, activist approach with certain companies. We had 12 managers in the developed country portfolio at the end of May, and the top five managers were 62%. Portfolio continues to be about one-third U.S., one-third ex-U.S., and one-third global. Next slide, page 26, for the emerging markets equity portfolio. Performance for both fiscal year-to-date and the 12 months ended May has been strong. We outperformed the benchmark by over 600 basis points, both fiscal year-to-date and in the 12 months ended May. We benefited from strong alpha from our country managers in China, India, and Russia, as well as our allocation to the Middle East and North Africa, which as you mentioned has seen stronger outperformance versus broad emerging markets. And those more than offset the negative effects of being overweight to China. In terms of our portfolio construction, the pie chart on the right, we had 17 managers at the end of May. The portfolio is now about 45% Asian managers, 33% global emerging markets managers, and 22% other regional EM managers. We have two new managers since last quarter, Sagatree and Tyborn. Sagatree is a concentrated Asia-focused manager founded by Catherine Tan, who was a former portfolio manager at Treeline and Lloyd George. Tyborn is a global manager with an Asia tilt founded by Ishwar Krishnan, who was a senior investment professional. So that's the EM portfolio. And Amanda and Russ and Kyle and I also wanted to thank Kathy. The book is in a very different place than it was 6 years ago when Amanda and I joined. And Kathy has struck a wonderful balance between providing guidance and oversight and perspective while letting us run the portfolio. So we really appreciate that. And Kathy personally has been one of the best possible mentors that I've had. So I miss you. I'm really excited to be here.
And then the third. Potential weller upper is Ryan, because he'll also be reporting to me. Ryan, you've been here for 9 years almost.
Yes, sir.
And Courtney has been here for around 7 years, so not straight out of college. But why don't y'all talk about your $10 billion hedge fund? Drury has been here for, how long have you been here now?
4 years.
Okay.
And we have two additional team members that are presenting today. Jenna in the back has been with us for a year and has really hit the ground running, as well as Allison, who's an associate, been here 4 years and works remotely as her husband's in the military and she's moved a couple of times. So we're one of the larger
teams. Our military, the U.S. military.
Yeah. you know, one of the larger teams given the size of the portfolio. And Bruce and Kathy, even more often, have been great mentors. Courtney and I have seen a full cycle with Kathy. We've greatly benefited from that. I assure you, we spend many late nights downloading as much as possible from her, knowing this day would come. As we've gotten more responsibility the last couple of years, we formalized a lot of our decision-making processes and why we have conviction with managers and some of the good and not so good decisions we've made, and that's really helped us. So I can't think of a good time, but now is as good as any, and just want to say thank you. As we stand here today, the portfolio just crossed $10 billion for the first time. It's 10.1. A few statistics. Our weighted average management fee is 1.35%. Our incentive fee is 19.1%. The weighted average liquidity is 13 months. And the tenure that we've been with our managers is 8 years. And that really speaks to our full cycle approach. We really expect our managers to preserve capital in downturns, given the fees that we pay. And if they do a good job, we're then loyal in return. And a lot of our managers have appreciated that long history as Kathy's made phone calls. The performance continues to be good on a risk-adjusted basis in line with the history. We're up 9.3% fiscal year to date. This is about 3.3% ahead of the benchmark for the last 9 months. Really, since Kathy took over the portfolio in 2002, we've set out to achieve 8% nominal returns. And the way we thought about getting there and the way we have gotten there is kind of 2 to 3% from beta and 4 to 5% from alpha. And that's what we've achieved over the long run. That's what we continue to expect. And we think we can achieve that with half to a third of the volatility of the markets. Courtney is going to walk through the top 20 managers. They represent about 75% of the portfolio. We think they're very strong returners, but also safe hands. And as everyone thinks about the hedge fund industry, we're really betting on these 20 to carry the day. And then we have an important satellite program for about 25% that Drury is going to talk about in more.
Thanks. So on slide 28, you'll see a snapshot of the top 10 largest hedge fund relationships. It's $5 billion or so in assets and half of the LCC portfolio. Looking at the bottom left box, the average size investment we have with these managers is $500 million or 1.6% of total endowment and ITF assets. And the largest investment we've got is just shy of $700 million or 2.2%. We pay an average management fee of 1.2% across the top 10 largest, which is lower than what we see in the current market. This is due primarily to the fact that we've got some legacy investments that were made a long time ago when fees were much lower. The average tenure of our top 10 investments are 11 years, and there's three of the top 10 that have been in the book for 16. Looking at the top right box, the top 10 managers are larger in size. With firm AUM ranging between $5 and $150 billion for an average of $29 billion. However, the one very large firm does skew the average, and so the median is around $9 billion. Despite this, their larger size, we are Utimco Investment represents an average of 4.5% of these firms' assets, with the largest relationship being 8.5%. We are the largest investor with three of the top 10. And we are top five in four of our top 10 managers. And importantly, half of these managers are closed to new investment. So a key takeaway is that the relationship is mutually significant to both of us. Utimco has large investments with these managers, and we are key investors for these managers. It allows us better access. We think we have really good relationships over long periods of time.
And just on that one point about how many are close, you know, because these are larger managers, an average of $9 billion, the smallest is $5 billion, and a lot of people think, well, anybody could have invested with these guys, but you know, five of them are closed. You can't, no, you know, you can't even get into five of them. Now, five of them are still open, but
and a lot of the size has come from compounding with these managers over long periods of time. We've gotten there through investment performance. So
on that point, of the $10 billion, half is contributed capital and half is retained profit.
Looking at the gross exposures at the end of April, average for the group was 227 gross, and net was 61%, which is at the higher end of the range we'd see over a full cycle. And then we took a look and calculated the three-year composite performance of this group. They've returned 9% with a volatility of 6 over this period, which we think is strong. Slide 29. This is what we call the next 10 relationships. That's 25% of the portfolio, or $2.5 billion. On the box on the bottom left, you can see that the investment sizes are smaller than the top 10 cohort, averaging $250 million, with the largest being $350 million, and the average about 80 basis points of the total endowment in ITF assets. We do pay slightly higher management fees of 1.5% on average, but this is slightly mitigated by a lower incentive fee of 17.5%. The 10-year is also lower in the top 10, but it still averages 5 years, which we think is actually quite high relative to the industry. And in the top right box, you can see that the next 10 are smaller firms, relatively modest average assets of called $7 billion. However, we are more meaningful partners to this cohort of managers. We average approximately 11% of their firm assets. We're a top five investor with 9 of the 10.
And by the way, that 52%, that's one manager who's really a fund of funds, one of the few fund of funds we have, that focuses really on kind of global macro and commodity managers, which is an area that we didn't feel we had as much knowledge in. My guess is if you remove that 52.4%, the next highest concentration probably is 20%. I don't know if you know.
That's right.
Yeah.
So two follow-ups on that, and this gets to Arden's question earlier. If you look at the amount of assets that the firm manages that we represent, it really ranges between 2% and 8% is the sweet spot. We only have 5, 6, 7 that are, you know, 10, 12, 15% of assets, and then we do have the one.
It's one anomaly. I just want to make clear that
yep.
is pretty anomalous
yep,
for us in this book.
It's a custom fund of one.
Yep.
And so that's meaningful to us, meaningful to them. I think we have the right balance. The other thing is we called all of our managers to just ask them, where do we rank with you as a client? And 33% of our portfolio were their largest client. And 75% of the portfolio, we are a top five client. But they're of a scale that we don't have too much business risk for them. So it really does work.
Just to point out that these managers are smaller, a little more nimble, and we do see a wider dispersion of exposures, gross and net perspective. Also, it's not surprising to see a little higher return and higher volatility with these types of managers. So 9% over the 3 years and 7.3% volatility.
So on slide 30, the last slide covering the rest of our portfolio, So we have 21 satellite relationships. It's about a fourth of our portfolio, but a little over half of our total number of relationships. It's a bit harder to generalize across this group, so I would break it into three buckets for you. The first bucket is managers that are new to our portfolio. So that includes new launches where we're competing for capacity and that we've just recently added. The second bucket are sector and geography specialists. So managers that have strategies that are difficult to scale or that we think are appropriately sized relative to their opportunity set. And the third bucket are managers where we're building conviction or frankly have low conviction in them currently, and we don't want to size them up right now. I think there are four kind of interesting takeaways from this slide. The first is that this is where a lot of the turnover happens in our portfolio, where almost all the hiring and firing goes on. So you'll notice as a result of that, these have a little bit lower tenure in our portfolio. So whereas you might see a tenure of 5 to 10 years for our top 20 relationships, the tenure here is 3 years on average. The second thing is that these managers are smaller. On average, they're $2 billion in AUM compared to 5 to 10 billion for some of our larger investments. That's because a lot of these managers are in the early part of their life cycle or new launches, or they have strategies that are difficult to scale up. The third thing is that despite these being the smallest 21 relationships in our portfolio, we're pretty meaningful partners for these firms. For six, we're their largest investors, and for another nine, we're their, in their top five investors. So for 15 out of the 20, we're a top 10 investor, a top five investor. And then the last thing is that you may have noticed the composite performance for this group is a little bit lower than for the top 10 or the top 20. The composite performance for the top 20 was around 9%, and the composite performance for this group is around 6%. And I'd say if you get straight to it, not every manager in this part of the portfolio works out. Some of our worst performers are in this last group of 20. But we think they're appropriately sized for that kind of downside risk. And the second thing is that our high hit rate in the top 20 managers for people that we promoted up is a result of the time those managers spent in this portion of the portfolio, the multi-year period where we were able to get to know the manager and build conviction in them before adding capital. So that's the, that concludes our slides, and thank you.
So question, so just doing some quick addition. Out of the 41 hedge funds, your top five and 16 of them, it looks like, just doing the quick math. Do you believe that's good, bad, or? It's not relevant.
We view it as a partnership, and we don't want to be just a check chasing returns. We try to really understand their background, why they should continue competing and winning over time, and ultimately, the more confidence we have, the more we trust their judgment running the business, the more we grow over time. And I think with our reputation in the industry, we will introduce other managers to speak on our behalf to try to negotiate for capacity, because it's very competitive out there with fund-to-funds, sovereign wealth funds, pension funds, and we try to go with the higher pedigree new launches that prefer the endowment, you know, capital.
You know, some of the latest examples may have read the Ziff brothers were kind of shutting down their internal hedge fund operation. And so a number of the most talented portfolio managers, investors that used to be part of the Ziff brothers are spinning out. And we're talking to a lot of them, and we've invested with two of them. One's done, one's about to get done. And, you know, as you might imagine, these guys are having more money offered to them than they're taking, which is good. And they're still taking a fair amount of money, $1.5 billion, $1 billion. I mean, these aren't little baby starts, they're significant starts. Having said that, you know, they've got $3-4 billion offered to them. And, you know, we're in there competing. And one of the advantages we have is the reputation. One of the advantages we have is some of our other partners talk to these guys and say, hey, Utipco's a good partner to have, you know, that's, and so I think, I know in one of them we are their largest.
Yep.
The second one, I'm not sure if we are.
We're not. Probably top 10. But yeah.
So, you know, the answer is when it works out, we're glad we're the largest. In some cases where it doesn't work out, it hadn't been to our advantage. But ideally, we'd like to be the largest because we, you know, ideally they'll work out.
So you believe that gives you some competitive advantage in, through reputation or entree into other funds, because they're not going to treat you any different than they do the guys at the 1%, do they?
Never.
They do?
Yes, of course.
Better fees?
Sometimes. Given the supply and demand, oftentimes it's not fees. A lot of times it's, you know, additional capacity. It's when they have special opportunities, special ideas. Part, if you go back to that first page, our top 10 managers, particularly some of them that aren't closed. But where we have an advantage is they'll have an idea for a strategy, a European credit opportunity or an Asian special situations opportunity. These are real examples of the past few years, and because of Kathy's, Ryan, Courtney, Drury's relationships with them, and we're in constant contact, they offer them to us.
And not the 1%.
In fact, not anybody else. And we'll put $100 million or $200 million into that strategy, and those have worked out phenomenally well.
And when I made a bunch of calls to tell the managers I was leaving, one thing that was persistent was that they really appreciated our long-term nature.
Yes.
And we went through 2008 with a lot of them. And I think that really has added a tremendous amount of value to the program, because these guys do talk to each other and they remember that, and they want investors like us because they feel like we can be long-term partners, and we get great access. Mm. A lot of information. They've helped us in other parts of the portfolio. So that's just kind of another end note.
My manager shared with us that we were 10% of their assets. We took up 20% of the PM's meeting time. We actually tracked that.
Yeah.
And,
it's good.
Yeah. Okay. I want to spend a little more time with the hedge fund portfolio because it is such an important part of the book. And we're going to eat very soon. We're going to eat just very soon. Like 5 to 10 minutes. Very soon. Assuming the food's ready, I bet it is.
Been ready.
Page 31.
Waiting on you.
Page 31, 43 in Diligent, just a snapshot of all of our private investments. Just focusing on the right, a $6.8 billion portfolio with $4.6 billion of unfunded. Those numbers are larger than at the beginning of the year in dollar amounts, but roughly the same in percentages. In the middle, that 15.2% is the 9 months annualized return. Every part of the book is doing well. Emerging markets not as well. The venture up 31%. You know, we've talked about Twitter and others, but good returns across that book. And it's been self-funded. We've gotten $1.25 billion of distributions versus $1.2 billion of calls. Even though we're building up the book, there's just been a lot of monetizations. Next page, wanted to give you an update on co-investments. Here the points I'd like to make is that across real estate, natural resources, and private investments, we've looked at, this says 96. When we first started, we weren't tracking it as diligently as we are now. So I'd say we've looked at least 100 co-investment opportunities. A little over 50 we thought were interesting, and we've committed to 28. 27 have actually been invested. Five of them, and by the way, and so that's $610 million of commitments we've made in co-investments. There are seven that we're currently looking at, may or may not do, $155 million. Five of them have actually returned some capital. One, the big one, in natural resources, have returned most of the capital. So we're still in the very, very early innings, but based upon return capital realized and then the marks in the book, it's at a 1.4 times multiple of capital and a 28% net IRR, because for the most part, we're not really paying any fees on this. The next page shows the investment activity. In the interest of time, I'll just summarize it real quickly. On the redemption side, we talked about the Old Mutual redemption and investment grade fixed income. We did redeem from one of our hedge fund global macro managers. In natural resources, that redemption was Schroeder, which was invested in Wellington. And we've had some, we redeemed from one of our long-only emerging market managers. In terms of on the investment side, Susan mentioned Ashe, the $100 million investment in the long-only developed country book, and some of our new managers in emerging markets, Tyburn, Sagatry, et cetera. We made just under $750 million of commitments this quarter, a busy quarter for us, spread across the private equity book. And on the next page, the only number I would point to is the $1.9 billion of private equity commitments that we made through the first 9 months. And I mentioned we think we're on track to around $2.4 billion. ITF, not much has changed. 44% in hedge funds, about 35% in long-only bonds. Very, very liquid is the way we run that book. And really no new contracts. So that's the funds update.
Okay, good. We'll break for lunch. We have an outside guest coming in. So what I'd suggest we do is pick up, press the button. Bruce.
Yes, are we ready?
We're going to do the organization update.
Yes, sir. If you look behind tab 4, which is page 52 in Diligent. Actually, let me jump to 53. I always like to share with you the organization chart. We've had one new person join us, Jacqueline Pazinski, who's not here today, but is helping Sissy out in compliance. We did have two director positions become open on the bottom left, one in private markets, one in natural resources. We were sorry to lose those folks. They had been with us for 6 to 8 years. They were really producing well for us, and they just got very attractive offers from the private segment. To the right of that, that red open position in real estate has been budgeted all year, but we just haven't been active in that. And then, and same with the analyst position in marketable alternatives. In the far right, we've got a programmer position open, which Uche is beginning interview for, in particular, this investment support system, document management system that we've been heavily investing in with our consultant partners, Globark. We'll get the source code in a few months, and so the idea is that this programmer will be focused on that. The next page, I just wanted to spend a minute kind of bragging on Sissy. You know, a question had come up in earlier meetings is, gosh, what does a compliance person do, and how much, you know, whatever. So, so I've been spending much more time with Sissy over the last 6 months, and really trying to kind of get a deeper understanding of this job we call compliance and corporate legal. And I got to tell you that I'm overwhelmed. It is a lot of stuff. It is important stuff. And by the way, if any of y'all want to do it, let me know, because it's not always necessarily the most exciting stuff, but it is really important. And so if you just look at the list, just on compliance, ongoing compliance, it starts under the umbrella of enterprise risk management. And Sissy updated that effort, which she did for the first time a number of years ago, that really takes this holistic and comprehensive approach to enterprise risk management. What are the risks for the whole enterprise? And coming out of that, we're monitoring plans for every function. I've got one. And then, you know, every month, every quarter, we review how we're doing on those plans and are we keeping an eye on enterprise risk. Code of ethics is a big deal in this organization, as you all know. You and we've all made filings. We do conflict of interest. We have pre-clearance, you know, on and on. New investments. Every time we make a new investment, there's a lot of compliance activities, from certificates to delegation of authority and mandate categorizations. It's just good flow. Sissy is one of our key contacts with UT System, their compliance program, their general counsel, and the Board of Regents. And we have lots of policies and procedures. We went over some of them today, the investment policies, but believe me, we have a lot more. That's not the full set. And, you know, part of compliance's job is making sure all those policies and procedures get followed. UTIMCO is kind of a small business, $25 million $30 million budget, 60-ish people. But there are legal responsibilities, used to be done externally, move that in-house, whether it's preparing for all these meetings, we have contracts we enter into, there's a lot of employee benefit related things, which Sissy has a great background in. Things like Dodd-Frank or the European market infrastructure, we're not regulated per se, but those things impact us and they impact our managers. We get a lot of open records requests, we have tax matters, just continued list. Sissy runs point on us on various periodic projects, like when the legislature's in session, when we get audited by the state, records retention, et cetera. And then because Sissy was the last to say not it, there's certain other projects that she's taken the lead on, frankly, because we thought she'd do a really good job, our business continuity plan. Arguably, that doesn't really fall under the domain of compliance and legal, but it was a very interdisciplinary task, interfunctional task, and Sissy's been leading that effort. We've been setting up these special purpose vehicles. We negotiate our own ISDAs with counterparties. Sissy's taken the lead on that. As I mentioned, we've just hired the compliance specialist, and Sissy's been kind of helping John Ellison as he's come into the firm. So I just want to thank you, because when I went through this list, every time I get to the end, I kind of have to take a breath of air, because I think it's a lot. I think it's important. So I wanted everybody to know how much you do, and didn't know if Sissy would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Sissy, do you bring in outside counsel when you negotiate the UTEMCO ISDAs, or do you do it
we
all
have,
on your own?
Yes, we have Dan Nosa. He's over at Jackson Walker. He's helped us with those.
Bruce, as I told you when we talked about this before, I've practiced in this area. There's a whole lot to it. If you're really doing your job really well, it's sort of invisible. But when the SEC shows up or when a client shows up and all of those things happen, you're very, very glad that you've done it right. And obviously, it is being done right, and we appreciate it.
The next page I just wanted to highlight, I mentioned John joining the firm. When we looked at our deal legal fees, our external legal fees, I think back in fiscal year 08, they peaked at $1,350,000. We have 56 deals we did. Then it fell down the next year. We only did 20 deals. And then the last years, kind of 10, 11, 12, it was in that $800,000, $1 million range. We were doing anywhere from 30 to 50 deals. And our deals were costing us about an average of $22,000. Every time we made an investment, we hired external lawyers, and on average, they cost us about $20,000. So, we began to ask ourselves whether we ought to have an internal deal legal representation. In classic UTEMCO fashion, we tried to do a lot of analysis. We talked about it a lot, thought about it a lot, probably spent about 6 months kind of deciding whether we wanted to do it, and then we decided we did. And so then, also in classic UTEMCO function, we then spent 6 months to a year trying to find people and, trying to find the right person. And we were very fortunate to have found John in, 15? Is John here?
John's here.
There's John. How long have you been with us, John?
About a year and a half.
Year and a half. So in fiscal year 13, you see that dip from 800,000 to 600,000. And this year, John's first full year, you see that we're probably going to come in around 200,000. And so, clearly documentable cost savings. And but what you don't see on this chart, but what I think my investment colleagues would all attest to, is that not only has the service level gone up, we know where John sits, it's not even a phone call away, he's at most a hundred feet away, but the quality's gone up because he has helped us share best practices across teams. And so I just wanted to give a shout out to John on that.
And I think another benefit of that, and I think it's exceeded all of our expectations, is we're capturing the terms better. We're more institutionalizing about our investments. They were all kind of individual one-off investments. I think John's doing a great job of helping us capture the legal terms and really capturing the institutional, you know, IP all the way across the firm, the way everybody does their individual negotiations. So it's had additional benefits, I think, from what we even anticipated.
You know, and part of why, I think that's right, and part of why we thought it was a good initiative, there are certain partners where we are term takers, with a Blackstone Real Estate, with an Oaktree, with some of these new hedge funds that are oversubscribed. But even there, that's maybe not the best example. But with the really big guys, we don't really have much leverage on terms or governance, or, you know, they send you the document, you know, if you don't want it, someone else will. But more and more, what we're doing is trying to get there early, trying to be of significance, and in a number of cases, putting people in business. And there, you know, we give them our contract, or, you know, we really are, I think, pretty aggressive on terms. And, you know, again, I hear it from you guys tell me, but, you know, Linda likes to tell me, Ryan, whatever, tells me, we I think, have a reputation for being pretty aggressive and tough on terms. So having someone like John, you know, helping us with that, it's a big help. And then, as always, I thought it was important for Uche to give you an update on our technology platform, because, again, under his leadership over the last couple of years, we're like practically a real technology group now.
Thanks very much, Bruce. On top four, slide six, and page 56 in the board books, what we wanted to give you was a summary of our activities all through the year. I think the last few presentations to you has been centered around the investment support system. So we wanted to share with you all the things we do with the team as well. The team's been very busy working on improving the service we provide to our clients from a technology perspective. And one of the ways we did this was, initially we only had an Austin data center, and we got another UT system data center in Arlington. And what we've been gradually doing all through the year has been migrating our critical systems and enabling them, enhancing them to run simultaneously from both sides. And this helps us not only from a business continuity perspective, but we have quarter end runs, month end runs that peak beyond our regular run rate, and we can expand to handle the load rather than have a failure and have to restart. So that has been great for us. And on top of that as well, after CC's leadership in helping us finalize our business continuity plan, Bruce sprung a surprise on us earlier in the year and had everyone evacuate the office to go do a disaster recovery test. And
we tested our disaster recovery plan. I think one Tuesday night, I called Melinda and said, people can't come in the offices. There's a fire on the 28th floor. You can't come into our offices. And so then, you know, that activated our tree, and people got called, and what are they supposed to do? And we got it about I made a couple mistakes, I found out. And, you know, we probably got it about 80-85% right, you know. But we not only with Sissy developed the plan, but we had our first test. It won't be our last test. We're going to test it again. So
we passed, but there's still a lot of work to do, and we continue to improve that as we go along. So another part of our existing platform was improving our cybersecurity capabilities. And one of the things we had to do before, which was very time consuming, was monitor all of our systems, make sure we're up to speed, and manually update them, and it took a lot of staff cycles, and we finally implemented a system that allowed us to automate a lot of those tasks. So that has been very helpful in stabilizing our existing platform and reducing outages from security updates.
Before you go to the next page, the top of the page is important. None of these words probably mean too much to too many people other than Joan. You might remember before Uche got here, our technology platform was 80% focused on operations, accounting, and reporting. We made sure we could move money around. We made sure that we could account. We made sure that we reported to our clients, et cetera. That was all in Joan's shop. And there was a lot of, you know, technology support for that, as there should be. When Uche got here, I said, look, let's do all this stuff for the investment teams. But by the way, you know, you can't forget Joan. And what Joan wants, Joan gets. And so all these systems you see here up at the top were the, you know, major backbone, the major systems that Joan and her team uses. And so, you know, you not only kept, you answered Joan's calls, and you not only kept those systems going, but you worked to enhance those systems. And so, you know, I always hate to put Joan on the spot. I never hate to put that. Are you still in operation? Is technology still taking care of you?
Of course.
Okay.
Always.
All right.
So those enhancements are ongoing, and you know, as we do more, we'll update you. So on
the cybersecurity, how much time are you spending on that? Are you engaging outside security firms to help us with this, or
we're actually in the lucky position of leveraging a lot of UT Systems capabilities. So okay. They have teams dedicated to okay. it. So we, you know, we take recommendations from them as Chief Information Security Officer sits with their team meetings, and we, you know, so as they do all of the work, we take the best ideas from them and we implement it. So yes, we have external companies help us, but opportunistically, not on an ongoing basis. I mean, they will come in if we have to do a code review, for example. We want to check everything for security or do penetration testing, but UT System provides all.
And we're going to do some of that. That's part of, you'll see in the budget, we're going to do some of that.
Correct.
In FY15. That being an external firm, checking new code, all that, because in addition to what we've been doing with UT System.
The next slide, page 57 for slide 7. This gives a summary of where we are with the investment support system. As you can see, the document center is in use, and we're slightly ahead of schedule on that. And what we're doing is diverting some resources from there into our data integration. And once the data integration gets to a critical point, we start working on portfolio analytics, enhancing our existing systems. We continue to make very good progress, and you know, we'll continue to give you more progress reports as we make the progress.
Yeah, we're about a year, maybe a little over a year, into what we kind of thought was a three-year project. I think this next year is a tough year. It's a hard year. The things that you're tackling are tough. This data integration are things like sales. What we had been using Salesforce as kind of a contact management system, and so really trying to integrate that, bring it in, integrate that more. You know, there's some hard things to do. And the portfolio analytics is to kind of make available to the investment teams the details, the security level details, et cetera, that are available to our operations group right now. And, you know, it's more than that. But so, you know, I do think Uche and his team, Amon, and you know, are working hard and are focused. We have an idea of what we need to do. It's just a lot of hard work. It's just a lot. It's a big volume of kind of hard, detailed work over the next 12 to 18 months, I think.
Not just on the technology team, but on our investment teams, asking them to do a lot of data cleanup on top of their day job. So we'll give you more updates as we go. Thank you.
You're through though, right?
Yes, sir.
We'll go on to our committee report outs, and Kyle, or the risk committee.
Sure. Mr. Chairman. The risk committee met on July 23rd and joined with the policy committee today, technically. Committee was to discuss appropriate actions related to the minutes, categorization of new investment mandates, compliance reporting, performance and risk reporting. We had a great discussion earlier today, and I don't think that we took appropriate action related to the new 19 mandate characterizations, and we'll report to the UTIMCO board the results of its review of the mandate characterizations. All we had going on
today. Any questions? No action items?
No, other than the 19.
Right. Okay, thank you. We'll go on to the Audit and Ethics Committee, John.
Okay. The Audit and Ethics Committee convened on July 22nd by teleconference. All of our members attended, and the chairman attended as well, Chairman Foster. The committee considered four action items during that meeting. First, we approved the minutes of the April 29, 2014 meeting, and they were approved as drafted. Deloitte & Touche LLP was approved as the corporation's auditor, subject to the UTEMCO board approval, which will be an action item today under tab 6. UT System Audit Offices presented their fiscal year 2015 audit plan, and that was approved by the committee. And the committee approved the base salary, performance incentive plan, participation and performance goals for the 2014-2015 fiscal year, and performance period for the general counsel and chief compliance officer as a joint recommendation with the CEO to the compensation committee. Then we heard reports from Mike Peppers from the UT System Audit Office. Sissy gave us a report on compliance, audit, and reporting matters. And Joan gave us a report on the unaudited financial statements for the investment funds in UTEMCO for the 3 months ended May 31st. The committee is recommending the board approve the Deloitte as a corporation's external auditor for fiscal year 2014. As I say, there's a resolution under tab 6 requesting that approval to engage Deloitte as the independent auditor. And that is the report.
Okay.
Any questions or comments? Hearing none. That's it.
Let's see. We need to have a motion now.
Yep. So move.
Second.
All in favor, aye.
Aye.
That was just the one motion we need, right?
Yeah. Correct.
Okay, good. Policy Committee, Jeff?
Sure. Policy Committee met today, July 29th, both separately and jointly with the Risk Committee. We did a couple of things. One, we approved the minutes from our previous April 29, 2014 meeting. And secondly, most importantly, we discussed in quite detail the appropriate action related to proposed amendments to the investment policy statements, liquidity policy, derivative investment policy, and delegation of authority policy. This is a required event. The current investment policies have to be reviewed each year annually, and it encompasses distribution guidelines, long-term investment return expectations, expected risk levels, asset classes, investment types, etc. We do have a resolution that comes out of, I believe, the Joint Policy and Risk Committee. I can handle this, but effectively it is, do you want to go ahead with that resolution?
Yeah.
So the resolution is that the amendments to the investment policy statements of the Permanent University Fund, General Endowment Fund, Permanent Health Fund, Long-Term Fund, and Intermediate Term Fund, and amendments to the derivative investment policy. We have stricken the delegation of authority policy so that no longer is included, and liquidity policy as presented be hereby approved. Do I have a motion on that?
So moved.
Second.
Second.
Aye.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you. That concludes our business.
Okay. Let's see. I don't think there's any reason for an executive session on compensation, right? Somebody knows one. Otherwise, we'll turn it back to you.
So. Can we do it for 5 minutes, maybe?
Yeah.
I'm not trying to hold things up, but we've got Lee on the line, and I think it'd be good to bring the whole board up real quick.
Okay. All right.
Where we are. So.
All right. Prior to going into executive session, I need to say the board directors of the University of Texas Investment Management Company, having been duly convened in open session and notice of this meeting, have been duly given, I hereby announce the convening of a closed meeting as an executive session for the purpose of deliberating individual personal matters, including the CEO, Chief Investment Officer, pursuant to section 551.074 Texas Government Code. The date is July 29th, 2014, and the time now is 2:03. Read the compulsory words.
Hey, Morris, how much longer do you think we're going today?
We're gonna be through by 3 o'clock for sure.
No, 5 or 10 minutes.
We're Five or ten minutes. Jeff and I got another one we've got to go do. So, yeah, did you hear that? 5 or 10 minutes.
Okay, thank you.
You got to go get on the beach or what? That's all right. You don't have to answer that.
I'm sure. Sorry, you're probably having to wear a sweater.
We got one in upstate New York and one in California.
Oh, who's in California?
Hard K.
All right. Let me reconvene the open session.
That's crazy.
Open session of the Board of Directors of the University of Texas Investment Management Company is now reconvened. The date is July 29, 2014, and the time now is 2:18. During the executive session, the board deliberated individual personal matters, but no action was taken or decisions made. No vote was called for or had by the board in executive session. And Kyle, I'll turn it back to you for either further discussion or those items we need to take action on.
We took action on setting the comp levels for the CIO as well as the staff. We approved the minutes of the prior compensation committee meeting, and then we also went through to other resolutions that approved various appendices, basically. We updated and amended tables 1, 2, and 3, copies of which attached to the documents, and adopted and approved to replace the current appendices of C, D, and E, respectively, as of September 1st, 2014, and that motion was passed. That is.
And then at this, we need the board.
Yeah, we need the board
to approve my compensation.
Understood. Got it. So.
But not C, D, and E.
And C, D, and E.
Yeah.
And
okay, C, D. Right.
So moved.
So. let me go back real quick. So to the board, we have a couple of action items. One is we need to approve base salary of the corporation's officers and other UTEM.
No, that one you don't have to.
Don't have to.
Just you.
Just me.
Okay. So Bruce's $690,000 big salary is something that the board hereby, the committee recommends to the board of directors of UTEMCO that we approve the base salary of the corporation's CEO for the fiscal year 2014-2015 in the amount of
$690,000. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carried.
Motion carried.
Thank you.
And that's it?
Then we need the the recommendation for
CD&E.
CD&E.
Yeah.
Coming. So the committee also recommends to the board that the updated and amended tables 1, 2, and 3, copies of which are attached here to, are hereby adopted and approved to replace the current appendix C, D, and E, respectively, effective September 1st, 2014.
Second. Or move.
Move.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And there was actually one more, the charter.
Oh, the charter.
We amended the
charter.
The compensation committee charter, which the board has to approve.
For that?
185.
Which one?
Page 185.
I was in the comp committee.
Oh, book. Sorry.
So, no, I'm there. Here we go. Resolve. Last action item, the amendments to the charter of the compensation committee be hereby approved in the form submitted to the corporation's board of directors.
So moved. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Motion carried. Okay, any other compensation?
No, sir.
All right, Bruce, to you for 5 minutes, and we're out of here.
Budget, tab 9, page 193, in Diligent. The UTEMCO budget, $25,428,000, a 3.9% increase over last year, $958,000. As you can see, about 80% of it's compensation. We've talked a lot about compensation. On the next page, we show the salary increases. We've also put in for filling the unfilled, three unfilled positions that we've had open, as well as five new investment people. Obviously, Kathy's retiring, which wasn't reflected in the above numbers. And then, you know, we're not going to hire everybody on day one, and hopefully we won't, but probably we will lose someone or more than one person during the course of the year. So those are the three components of it. The staff adds, we developed on a bottom-up, one-by-one. Do we think that there's a investment opportunity in a particular area? And if so, do we think we have the current resources, quantity, quality, or should we? Do we think we need to bring someone on board? And that's how we came up with those ads. As a check, a top-down check, we looked at how peer universities were staffed with their external management program, and you know, determined that even with these ads, we would be the most efficient. So it didn't seem like we were way out in left field. Incentive compensation is budgeted to be flat. And then the other UTIMCO expenses are budgeted to go up 5%, $245,000. $150,000 of that is related to the new hires, search firm fees. We have hired a search firm to help us with two of the positions. There will likely be some relocation, et cetera. And that's really, and then, you know, there's some additional expenses associated with the technology build out, and that's really the budget. The direct costs is mostly the custodian fees. It is budgeted to come down because, again, some efficiency initiatives that in particular Joan has undergone in terms of pooling our investments, so we don't have to set up three separate investments, one for the PUF, one for the JEF, one for the ITF. And then we have a capital budget, a little over, $1,372,000, which does continue to grow a bit, in part the IT project, but also we put in $70,000 of leasehold improvements. Should we add people, we probably need to do a little restacking of offices. So, for example, we may take Kathy's office and split it in half, so we have two offices there. And then our analyst told us that their biggest gripe was that our copiers are always broken, and they are. So we said, well, let's get a couple copiers. So that's and then in, you know, next last page you see 6.9 basis points projected. So that's the
action required on that.
Yes, sir.
Okay, you want somebody to put that in the form of a motion?
Second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carried. We got anything else?
No, sir.
All right, Arden, did you hear that? Unless you want to prolong the meeting.
No, sir.
All right, if nobody's
getting I'm good.
Nobody's getting further business, we will adjourn this meeting, and our next meeting is scheduled for October the 9th. And we will give Bruce another attaboy. We'll put a star for finishing a meeting early. So,
good meeting,
guys. Thank everybody for your participation.
Thanks, Morris.